Well, it's been, I think it's been just a little bit over 6 weeks now since the Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 went missing. And as far as I can tell, I checked the news today, they still haven't found it. And the tragic thing is about this is that families, they're grieving without answers and without any hope that they will find out about what happened to their loved ones. And that's quite tragic. But I think one of the things that intrigues me about this event is the way that all the nations have lined up to prove to the rest of the world how great they are. All right, and so you get them lining up and, you know, they're kind of showing off their military hardware and their technology. So someone comes along and says, look at this boat. And then China comes along and says, look at this satellite. And then along comes someone with a drone, a plane, and finally the Americans come along and say, well, look at my Bluefin submarine drone. And we're all like, okay, you win. And apparently they're the ones who are leading the charge. They're our only hope, the Americans with the Bluefin drone. And despite the most advanced technology in the world today, we still haven't found flight MH370. And this troubles us. It really troubles us. And perhaps that's why the newspapers are no longer covering this story. I mean, the story has not got less interesting. Every week, some new amazing piece of technology is pulled off the shelf and thrown in the water. The story's getting more interesting, and yet the newspapers are covering it less and less and less. And I wonder, why is that the case? You know, in the beginning, all the nations showed up, and they showed up to prove how powerful they were, how smart they were, how, you know, this crazy thing that happened in Asia, they will prove what actually happened. And you know, their hope is that our great power and technology will locate the plane, but we haven't. And that's starting to embarrass us, not just the newspapers, but to embarrass us as human beings. Because most of us in the world, we do think that something like this couldn't happen. Surely, we, the most advanced society in the history of the world, would be able to find a plane. You know, we think that we've got the power to control nature. Surely we've got the power to control death and evil if it's a terrorist attack, which we're not sure was. But this incident shows us that we're actually not in control of nature, that we're not in control of death, and we're not in control of the forces of evil. And when we're forced to admit that, it's actually very embarrassing. And perhaps that's why the newspapers are not covering this as much today, because as human beings, we're embarrassed by the fact that we're not in control of this world, despite the amazing technological advances we've had in the last century. Our plans, they're frustrated by forces outside of our control, and we're reminded we're not in control. And so this strikes at our insecurities, doesn't it? And it reminds us that we, our lives, our world, our families, that life is fragile. And you see, we even think that death is under our control. And we think, sure, we may not be able to stop it, but surely we're able to plan for it, to control it, to, you know, control the timing of it in the comfort of a hospital. For instance, we think we can control it, plan it, and dignify death. And death refuses. It comes along and says, no, I refuse to be dignified, and it won't be dignified, because it is the greatest enemy our world knows, and it is the greatest foe in your life, because it can take away everything that is best about our world from you. Death, it wasn't an issue for me until I turned 16, when my cousin died after an 8-year battle with the AIDS virus. He didn't contract it himself. He was a prison guard in Long Bay Jail, and he was working overtime. And at the age of 21, he was stabbed with an infected needle. And he spent the next 8 years struggling with that illness and died at the age of 28. And then I discovered for myself how painful death is, not least because it severs relationships with the people that are dearest to us. And loving relationships, they're so hard to come by. And I remember being at a funeral of someone, I can't remember who it was, and they said something like this. Someone at this funeral said something like, those whom we love never really go away. And that's a lie. And that's why death is so painful, because those we do love deeply do go away. And so it's terrible. And in our world is in denial about death. And we're so desperately afraid of not having an answer to it that we bury our head in the sand and we pretend it doesn't exist. Or if it does exist, we come up with some Hallmark card that says something we hope is true, but really we know isn't true. And you know, despite how the world will celebrate if we do find flight MH370, it's not going to be a great victory for mankind. It's not going to be a great victory, because what we'll find is a big metal coffin with bodies in it. And that's tragic. And so here's the question: does Jesus Christ have anything to offer our world? Is there any hope in the gospel for us to face the inevitable death that will face us? Is there anything apart from just mere wishful thinking that'll help me go through life actually not terrified at the prospect of what is coming at the end of it? Is there any hope for our world in which, though we find ourselves powerless, that we would actually have some kind of hope for what is coming next? And it's those questions which the story that Kat read for us in Mark chapter 5, it's that story which answers those questions. And might I say, this is the biggest question in life. Is there hope in the face of death? And so pick it up in verse 22. It says, one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. Jairus is one of the leaders of the synagogue, an important man, a powerful man, a man of reputation and honor, and yet here is this powerful man falling face down, flat on the ground before Jesus in utter desperation. He's got no one else to turn to. And we see why in verse 23, look at it. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My daughter is dying. Please come. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. Her little girl is dying." And unless something remarkable happens, there's no hope. Imagine the desperation and powerlessness of this man that you would feel if your own child were dying. That's the emotional intensity of this story. And those of us who are parents know the agony. I was just talking to Naomi about this last week. We know the agony of what it is to worry about our own children's lives being snuffed out. The worst day of my life was when we rushed Maisie, who is 6 months old, we rushed her off to Randwick Children's Hospital because she was having breathing difficulties. We got her into emergency and they rushed her through and put this respirator on her face. And as I sat beside her, I realized that one day, I knew it wasn't going to be that day, she was all right that day, but I knew that one day, not that day, maybe not even for 90 years' time, but I suddenly realized that one day she will die. And I'd never realized that before. I kind of felt like, if you're a parent, you know this experience. You feel like the kid you give birth to, they're going to live forever. And it was that day I suddenly realized, like I knew it theoretically, but I'd never known it with her. And I just felt like life seemed so harsh that my little baby girl is destined for the grave. That's her destiny. You know, it was Samuel Beckett, the great writer of theatre in the last generation, who said that we give birth astride a grave. It's such a brutal metaphor and picture of how life is so short and our destiny really is the grave. And you know, if you have kids, you know the terrible fear which comes to your heart in those moments. And the fear is raised when you hear about children dying. I've stood by the graveside of two of my friends' children. One died at age 6 months, the other died at the age 2 years. And it was terrifying. And Jairus comes to Jesus and he says, "My little girl, my little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she might be healed and live." This man, prominent though he was, powerful as he was, he was powerless in the face of the greatest foe the human race has, but he comes to Jesus. And so you can imagine Jairus' relief when Jesus agrees to go with him. And his insides would be churning that they would arrive by the bedside just in time to save her. And so they move off together, but as soon as they move off together, we're told, verse 25, that a woman was there who had had a flow of blood for 12 years, and she comes to Jesus for help. Now, what's Jesus going to do here? Is he going to say, "Sorry, not now. A girl's dying"? What is he going to do? This lady had been ill for as long as Jairus' daughter had been alive. 12 years, the both of them, and some people speculate about what that means. Ask James for his view on the matter. He's got a pretty whack view. But she comes to Jesus. And what Jesus does is he heals her, but he doesn't rush off. He sits her down and he actually has a conversation with her. He stops to talk to her and encourage her. And he's delaying his journey to this daughter who is dying. And I wonder if you can imagine Jairus' anxiety in that moment. This woman with a chronic condition is getting Jesus' attention instead of a little girl who has an acute condition. Jesus chooses to stop and talk with a woman who's been healed. He can move on. And yet he chooses to stop and talk to her rather than rush off to deal with the girl who is dying. Now, this makes absolutely no sense. It's irrational. It's malpractice. I mean, we've got some nurses here, right? Nurses, you triage your patients, don't you? And if you were to stop, Helena, I'm looking at you, right? If you were to stop and you were to help someone who just cut their arm open and it was bleeding, right? And you're like, "I've got to deal with this person." In comes this little 12-year-old girl who's dying. You're like, "You've got to wait. I'm just going to see this guy and put a Band-Aid on him first and make sure that he's, you know, he's not scared of what's going to happen next." You'd sue a nurse like that and you'd sue a doctor like that. Jesus is behaving like a reckless doctor at this point, isn't he? And his disciples would be saying to him, "What are you doing, Jesus? I mean, don't you understand the situation? It's going to be too late." Now pick up the story at verse 35. The thing Jairus feared most happens. Verse 35, while Jesus was still speaking, he's just yabba, yabba, yabba. Doesn't he know? While he's still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Now imagine how Jairus would have felt at that moment, standing around waiting for Jesus. He's like, "I know I've got to trust this guy, but Jesus, come on, I've told you, she's dying. What the hell are you asking about what this lady had had for breakfast? Quit it. Let's move on," he'd be thinking. And then finally, as they are ready to move on, the word comes. She's dead. And his heart sinks. And you see the assumption in that question Jairus' servant poses. Verse 35, "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" This is beyond the scope of anyone's help. So why bother Jesus anymore? While she was alive, maybe there was hope for her. I mean, we've seen Jesus cure fevers in the past. There would have been hope. Now she's dead. Don't bother the teacher anymore. And that may be the same question or assumption that you're making with situations in your own life. There are certain things this servant is assuming here that are beyond the scope of Jesus' sphere of authority, beyond the scope of Jesus' abilities, beyond the scope of Jesus' power, and therefore they say there's no hope. Why bother the teacher anymore? And it may be that there's some particular situation or distress going on in your life this week that you're dealing with, and you've given up, and you tend to think, well, why bother the teacher anymore? This is beyond the scope of Jesus' help. And that's what they assume. And I wonder whether that's what you assume. And so listen to what Jesus would say to you. It's what he said to Jairus. He says, verse 36, don't be afraid, just believe. In essence, Jesus says to Jairus, trust me. What he's saying here is that my love is compatible. It's compatible with what seem to be to you unnecessary delays. I know what I'm doing, he says to Jairus. I know exactly what I'm doing. And if you try and impose your understanding of your schedule on me, then you will struggle to feel loved by me in life. Don't be afraid, just believe. But she's dead, Jesus. And he's like, yes, I know. Don't be afraid, just believe. And here we see Jesus won't be hurried. And so often we feel like Jairus here, and we're like, Jesus, why don't you hurry up and do something about this? And we can't understand why on earth he would wait, why he delays, and we become impatient with God. And he seems to be irrational, and his delay seems to be unnecessary and unfair. And here we learn, no, Jesus' love is compatible with often what seems to be inexplicable delays. And it often looks like Jesus doesn't care, but he does care. He terribly cares. And here we learn that God loves us. And yet that doesn't mean that you won't experience great heartache in your life. You know, if I could just sit down with you and listen to the story of your life, it may well be that I'd join you and say, look, I've got no idea why God isn't coming through right now for you. I don't understand why he is delaying. But you've got to trust him right now. And so here's the question, is God delaying something in your life? And are you ready to give up on God and just say, well, I'm not going to bother you, God, anymore. If you're not going to come through right now, I wonder if you're impatient with him. And there may be one crucial factor that you've failed to take account of. And that's the reason why he's delaying. And the answer, as with Jairus, is to trust him. Trust. He doesn't tell him what is going to happen, right? Jesus doesn't tell this guy what's going to happen. Jesus doesn't tell you what's going to happen in your life, and it may involve great heartache, but he simply says, look at my character. Do you see in me someone reliable enough to bet your life on? Trust, not wish. He's not saying wish upon a star, not hope for the best. He's saying, trust me, depend on me. Am I powerful enough, Jairus, to bring you through this? You see, he isn't saying just muster up some irrational wishful thinking. That's what Richard Dawkins thinks faith is. No, faith is looking at the evidence of Jesus' character and credentials and saying, no, actually, I can trust him with this. Jairus, Jesus says to him, can you trust me? If you can, don't fear about what's going to happen next. And isn't it true that in any crisis, Jesus' words to Jairus are the same command and instruction that we need? And isn't it all that is required of us? G. Campbell Morgan was one of the great preachers of a former generation. And there was a time when his firstborn daughter was lying at the point of death. And he spoke about that moment years later as he was preaching on this very story in the Gospels. And this is what he writes. He says, "I can hardly speak of this matter without becoming personal and reminiscent. Remembering a time 40 years ago when my own first lassie lay at the point of death, dying. I called out for him then, and he came, and he surely said to our troubled hearts, 'Fear not, believe only.' He did not say, 'She shall be made whole,' and he took her to be with himself. She has been with him all these years, and I have missed her every day. But his word, 'believe only,' has been the strength of all the passing years." Jesus isn't promising you that you won't have a life free of heartache. But he is saying, trust me with what's coming next. I will bring you through it. And so let's go to the climax of this story and see what happens next. Jesus went with the man, verse 37, and he didn't let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. In that day, you wouldn't mistake someone who is dead for someone who is in a coma. You know, we outsource death to professionals these days. They didn't have any such professionals in that day. They'd seen many, many dead people, and they knew this was a dead person, and they were wailing and in a great commotion. It says, Jesus saw the commotion with the people crying, and he went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child isn't dead, but asleep." And they laughed at him. And so the mourners are there, and there's this great commotion, and Jesus has the nerve to tell the father of a dead girl that she's just asleep. He must either be incredibly deluded or incredibly confident in his power to do something about this. And they laugh. This isn't a giggle. It's not a smirk. They ridicule him. It's the kind of ridicule our city will use against Christians at Easter as they laugh about the resurrection of the dead. They say, you know, what's the evidence for that? Even though there is great evidence, might I say. But to be fair, I kind of think this is fair enough. I mean, if someone rocked up to the funeral of my daughter and said that, I would ridicule them. I wouldn't just ridicule them. I'd beat them over the head, right? I kind of think this is fair enough. Just because, here's the thing, just because I want something to be true, that doesn't mean it's going to be true. And that's what they think Jesus is saying. Oh, she's sleeping, she's not dead, everything's going to be all right. You know, he gives his little Hallmark statement. I'm sorry, there is someone in here who works for Hallmark. I keep criticizing Hallmark. I apologize to you. I won't draw attention to who you are. But you know, they ridicule Jesus. And I kind of agree with it, you know. They ridicule him for his wishful thinking, not knowing that actually he has the power to wake this girl up. You know, so I would have done the same thing. And perhaps you laugh without ever checking Jesus' credentials for the promises he makes. That's what Christianity Explored is all about, actually. A low-key environment just to check out the credentials of Jesus. No pressure, just have a look at it as an adult. Most people, they say, yeah, I've read the Bible, but they did it as a kid. I mean, you need some integrity if that is you. Check out the Bible, the claim of the greatest religious figure in the history of the world. I'm not just saying that because I'm a Christian. I mean, I think that's fairly well recognized. Check out his claims as an adult. Read them for yourself. That's what Christianity Explored is about. And so verse 40, what does Jesus do? He puts all those who ridicule him out. And he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him, and he went in where the child was. And isn't this a lovely, intimate moment? Jesus puts the mockers outside. He doesn't want to do anything for show, to impress, to entertain. He doesn't try and restore their opinion of himself and say, you guys were laughing at me, look at this. He has no concern for himself. His only concern is this father and his child. And there is this very tender private moment when mum and dad watch as he sits down by her bedside. Verse 41, he takes her by the hand and says to her, Talitha kum, which simply means, little girl, I say to you, get up. These are the words Jairus would have used every morning to wake his daughter. The word Talitha, it's this pet name for a daughter. It's like saying honey. And so here comes Jesus and he just says, honey, it's time to wake up. And her eyes open and she gets up. And we're told this right at the end, they were completely astonished. Of course they were astonished. Jairus had come to see Jesus cure a fever, not to see Jesus raise the dead. And even the greatest enemy of all, death, to Jesus is just like a night's sleep. And so when Jesus says she's just sleeping, he doesn't mean she wasn't dead. She was, but Jesus knew that it'd be as easy as a parent to wake their daughter as it would be for him to reach down into death and lift this girl up again. And this is incredibly incredible. Here Jesus is facing the most relentless, unavoidable, and vicious enemy you have. And with the touch of his power, he reaches down into death and he lifts this girl out of it with no marks, no claw marks on her even. It is incredible. Death is the great foe of the human race. And Jesus rages against him. One of the moments I love most, and I preached on this last year, is the raising of Lazarus in John chapter 11. And when he comes to raise Lazarus out of death, it says that Jesus got furious with anger. And it surprises us. We know that story that Jesus weeps. And he does weep, but he also gets furious. Why? It's because he is so angry with what this enemy does to our own lives and the way it takes away from us the best things in our lives, which is our family and friends. And so he comes with this furious anger, mad, and he moves towards the jaws of death, fully aware that for him to lift this little girl out of the jaws of death, to lift Lazarus out of the jaws of death, for him to lift you out of the jaws of death, then he must go into the jaws of death for you. You know, the sting of death is sin. The sting of death is sin. Because we sin, we all die. We rebel against God the Maker, and the punishment for that is death and judgment. The sting of death is sin. But Jesus, we remember on Good Friday, he died for sin so that the sting of death would be removed. And 3 days later, he rises again, defeating death forever. And hundreds of people see him. We're told 500 people at one time see him. The religious leaders and the Romans, they don't know what to do. They want to quench this story, right? They don't know what to do, but they can't find the body. They look high and low. They can't deny that people are seeing this man they'd crucified, that they're seeing him all over the place. And people just keep telling people, I saw him. I saw him. And it's incredible. And people believe and people trust what their friends say, that they saw him. And those first eyewitnesses, the disciples, they go on throughout the whole Roman world telling people that they've seen a man the Romans put to death. And therefore this man, not Caesar Augustus, not Caesar the emperor, this man is God, the King, the Lord of heaven and earth. And as a result, they kill him. They kill him because they're saying, no, Caesar isn't Lord, Jesus is. And so they kill them. And yet they would rather face their own deaths with courage in order to stand up for what is true. They gain nothing out of this. No riches, no length of life. The only thing they get in return for telling people that Jesus is risen is death. And they die willingly that others would know that someone has conquered the grave. And so people, they listen. And this whole thing takes over the Roman world. 12 people terrified in this upper room in 30 AD when Jesus had risen. 12 people. And it spreads for the next 300 years to the point where Christianity becomes the dominant religion of the Roman Empire. You know, historians, they have a real big problem with this because they are convinced that there is no other explanation apart from the historical resurrection of the man Jesus Christ for the rise of the early church. I was listening to one professor at Oxford tell how he wrote this large book on the resurrection of Jesus, and how one of his colleagues said to him, simply, your argument's really good. I just prefer to think that there's another explanation that we haven't come up with. In other words, the historians are pretty unanimous about this, that the only plausible explanation that we have at our fingertips is that Jesus rose from the dead. You cannot explain the rise of the early church without it. Now, that doesn't force historians into believing Jesus rose. They say, well, I prefer to believe that there is an explanation, but we haven't found that explanation yet. It's been 20 centuries, right? The explanation is there was a God-man, Jesus Christ, who defeated death and rose again. He appeared to hundreds of people, and they went out telling people the story that death has been defeated, even at the risk of their own lives, and people couldn't help but believe they are speaking the truth. Jesus' own resurrection is the proof that death has been defeated. The monster death, it can't terrify you anymore because the claws, the stinger, it's been taken away. He's died for sins and has risen for your righteousness. And now death is not the end. It's not even the beginning of the end. It's not even the beginning of the end. What is it? I've written it down. I can't remember what I've written. It's just the end of the beginning. That's what I was trying to go for. Right? It's not even the end. It's not even the beginning of the... It's the end of the beginning. This life is just the beginning of the great and glorious life God's got planned for us. I mean, I love that little string that Dale just kept pulling out. Imagine that string coming down here and going out down the playground, out past Central, out along Parramatta Road, onto the M2, M4, M5, whatever it is, out past Mount Druitt, out to the mountains, up the mountains, past Katoomba, down into Lithgow, and it just keeps going. That is your life. And this little tiny bit here, that is your life now. And the rest is eternity. That's what he's got in store for you. And all who come to Jesus, that's what you've got looking forward to you. And that's why Christians are very excited Easter Sunday, because the resurrection of Jesus is the proof that he can do what he did for Jairus' daughter for us all. And that's why it's such good news. You know, there's this great poem by George Herbert. And there's this great place where George Herbert has this dialogue between death and the Christian. And death says something like this to the Christian. He says, "Let losers talk, yet you will die. These arms shall crush you." Now, what does the Christian say in response to that? This is what Herbert says. He says, "Spare not, do your worst. I shall be one day better than before, you so much worse, and you shall be no more." Now, what is Christian saying there? He's saying, come on, death, as you reach out to strangle me, instead of breaking me, you make me. And the worst thing that can happen if you're a Christian actually turns out to be the best thing that'll happen. Because after you wake up, the first face you will see is the Lord Jesus Christ, and he'll be as tender with you as he was to Jairus' daughter. The worst thing that can happen to you, to die, is actually the best thing that can ever happen to you. And so death becomes to the Christian a dark tunnel that you walk through as you get off the plane to paradise. That's all. Do you understand that? That's the way Christians live. And one day you will die, right? I mean, I think this is why people enjoy Christianity Explored, because we're just brutal in asking the hard questions. One day you will die, and after you've seen the evidence of Jesus' resurrection and his power in this story, the question you must ask yourself is, can you trust Jesus with your death? Now, if this man who has power over death, surely it would be madness just to ignore him and just to say, well, this is interesting, but it's unimportant. I've got more important things in life to explore. It's all right for you to believe, but you know, I don't really need to believe this. One day you will die. What hope do you have as you face that? There's this, that's what Jairus is telling you. Jairus' daughter did die again, and we assume that she buried her parents, Jairus and Mrs. Jairus, but one day she too would have been on her deathbed again. And if that day you asked her, are you afraid of the dark valley before you? She would certainly say, no, because I lost my fear of death when I was 12 years old, because I know that the first hand I hold will be his. He's come to you in the face of death, and therefore sorrow and tragedy, he will bring you through that. You know, this is why for centuries Christians haven't stood up at Easter Sunday and said, the stock market has risen. It has risen indeed. You know, it's, you know, every Easter they have not gathered and says, the almighty Australian dollar has risen. It has risen indeed. We haven't got together and said, the employment rate has risen. It has risen indeed, as though that is our great hope for our society. Here is the one hope that has held up human beings across every continent and culture for 2 millennia in the face of poverty, disease, pain, hardship, and death. Christ is risen. He is risen indeed, right? You know, in the last couple of years, I've watched two of my friends. I've watched them lose infant children, and it has been devastating. And one of my friends lost their son, Darby, at 6 months. And at the funeral, this is what he said. This is what he said. He says, we found great comfort in knowing that even when our circumstances seem out of control, God himself is in control. It is God's control in the midst of our pain that has given us great strength and hope. Many view faith such as ours as flimsy, a crutch, something one might cling to in pain that we're experiencing now. Yet we see at this time that what is flimsy and fleeting is us, and that it is God who is steadfast and constant and a rock, one who has designed each day that our Darby lived with. And as Darby is now gently embraced by his heavenly Father's steadfast arms, so Mandy and I feel his unaccountable strength and hide ourselves in his refuge. And so what do we learn today? Well, we learn that Jesus' delays are consistent with his love, aren't they? You know, why would you want to hurry somebody who is this powerful and this loving, who treats you this tenderly, who holds us by the hand and will bring you through life's darkest days? And some of you, you're trying to hurry him. And his words to you is simply, don't be afraid. Trust me. Another thing we learn here is that we can keep bothering the teacher, can't we? We can keep bothering the teacher because his love and power are sufficient for our needs. And we learn that he has removed the sting of death so that the worst thing that can happen to you is actually the best thing that could ever happen to you. And we learn that death is just a mere nap for those who die trusting him. Here's the question, what can give us hope in a world where we lose planes and infant children die? It's the strong hand of Jesus Christ who has the power to bring you through your darkest days. And so for the last time, Vine Church, as we go through and finish this series on Mark's Gospel, I'll tell you that it's time. It's time to find hope in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's time to know that Christ has indeed risen. It's time to know that death has been defeated, and it's time to plan your life with the end in mind. There is nothing like living with the immediacy of death in view that'll help you sort out your priorities in life. Are your priorities what they ought to be if one day you will die? I hope that's the message you've got from this series. Are your priorities in line with the fact that there is a day you will die? Are you preparing for that day? And it's time to plan your life with that, with the end in mind. One writer says, you've only got one life and it's soon going to be passed. Only what's done for Jesus Christ will last. Don't waste it. Don't waste it. Don't waste it. You know, it's time to tell our city that death, it loses. Life, it prevails. And not in the abstract, wishful thinking, but in the pulsing blood and flowing tears, the thumping heart, and that the resurrection is hope for us all. Vine Church, this is our time. Christ has risen. He is risen indeed.